Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. The agenda for today, the Monday, the February 12th, is going to be the Treasurer of the State, House Bill 5049, and the Treasurer's presentation of starting off the Investment Division. And we have Richard Solomon, the Treasurer, Mr. Edwards, and Ron Schnitz, and
we'll bring him up a short list, sir.
You'll bring him up when you need him, and Laura Lockwood.
McCall.
Yes. Good morning, all. Who's leading off?
I'll just start off. Thank you, and good morning. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. As I mentioned when we first came in about a little over a week ago, the Office of State Treasurer is really a highly sophisticated financial organization with a national reputation. In fact, last week we received a national award for our pension fund management from Plan Sponsor Magazine. They also recognized the work that you, the legislature, did a few years ago to change the pension system. I'm proud of the work that we do for retirees, taxpayers, Oregon companies, and families saving for college. You can be proud, too. We are here to present our budget to you and to ask for you to support our request. We'd like to begin our presentation this morning with an overview and a quick introduction of the Investment Division, and I'll introduce Dick Solomon, the chair of the Oregon Investment Council. But I want to give you just a little bit of context about this division. As I said earlier, this is an enormously large, complex, and effective investment machine, and is headed by Ron Schmitz. We currently manage $75 billion under management. 2 years ago, that was $61 billion. That's a 25%, approximately 25% increase. 10 years ago, it was $35 billion. That's more than 100% increase. We have 301 external managers and partners. In top performance, we perform at the top of our class in every category. I'm proud of the work that Ron and his staff does each and every day. I'd like to introduce again Dick Solomon, the chair of the Oregon Investment Council.
Before we move on to Mr. Solomon, let me ask Dallas if he would explain a little bit about what we have in front of us this morning and any other instructions he has.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at your place behind the agenda, you have the bill. You also have the Treasurer's Memorandum on Continuous Improvement, what the office is doing with respect to continuous improvement. This is required by the co-chairs before any agency goes to work session. And the Treasurer has also provided a response to questions that were posed during his overview of a few weeks ago. This week, today, we will be reviewing Treasury Services, which consists of investments, banking services, and debt management. Tomorrow, they will review the College 529 Savings Network, and also go into some detail with respect to a bill or the transfer of unclaimed property responsibility, which is in a policy option package a significant one to the Treasurer's office. And tomorrow we are scheduling public testimony also.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ready, Mr. Solomon.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. My name's Richard Solomon. I'm a CPA in Portland, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Investment Council. It's a pleasure for me to be here today to support the Treasurer's request to increase staff for the Investment Division. The Treasurer, the Governor, the Legislature, and all of us can be proud of the results that the Oregon Investment Council and the Investment Division have achieved in producing really outstanding results, which have resulted in really lower contribution rates for the state and employers, and ultimately results in lower taxes for the citizens of the state of Oregon. The council, the Investment Council, is faced with really two major challenges: managing this increased portfolio. As Randall said, that's increased from $60 billion to about $61 billion to about $75 billion in just the last 2 years. It's a very complex portfolio and requires a very high degree of skill on the staff to manage. We're also looking, although we are perhaps the best performing pension fund, state pension fund of our size in the country. We're always looking for ways to improve, and we're looking for new areas to invest that might improve our results. All of that takes additional staff time, and we operate on a very efficient staff. I think we have 15 people in the investment division. That's for $75 billion. It involves overseeing a large number of relationships, and we just we're stretched thin, and we need to increase the available people we have to manage those. I want to keep this brief, but we're looking to be the best fund we can be, and in order to do that, we need some additional help.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Before I introduce Ron Schmitz, the Chief Investment Officer for the state and the head of this division, before you have an outline of some of the things that are budget drivers. Certainly, as Dick just mentioned, we need to have staff to oversee and managing this growing portfolio of investments. Certainly, we need to retain and hire financial professionals. My priorities continue to be to make sure we prudently manage the billions that have been entrusted to us, as Dick said, also to find new opportunities to make money, and also to look for opportunities in the state, in the region. So with that, I'd like to introduce Ron Schmitz, the Chief Investment Officer for the state. And Ron will walk through you with you a little bit about the performance measurements and any questions you might have specifically about the division. And
for the record, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer, just so we're all truly on the same page, we're on tab one, and now we're starting on slide two of the presentation book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randall. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Ron Schmitz for the record. I'm the director of the Investment Division. My staff consists of 15 people who collectively manage over $75 billion, as you already heard. To break that down, OPERF is approximately, the PERS fund is approximately $60 billion, Oregon Short-Term Fund at $9 billion, and change. The safe assets that we manage are a little over $3 billion, Common School Fund of $1 billion, Oregon Savings Growth Account of $1 billion, and higher ed and some other small amounts of money. For most of the assets under our care, we're guided by the Oregon Investment Council, and that would bring me to OPERF, which is page 3 of the presentation that you have in front of you, the performance measure for OPERF. OPERF is our largest portfolio, and it's the flagship, if you will, of all of the portfolios that we manage. Not because OPERF is more important than the other portfolios, but because the other portfolios really piggyback off of what we do in the pension fund. A lot of the same manager relationships flow through to the other asset pools. At $60 billion, OPERF has a targeted asset allocation of 35% U.S. equity, 20% international stocks, 10% private equity, which includes mezzanine debt, leveraged buyout funds, venture capital funds, and the like, 27% fixed income, and 8% real estate. It's a very diverse global portfolio, and it keeps the 15 people in my department quite busy. Under virtually any measure, OPERF is a stellar performer. Independent custodian bank risk-reward plots consistently show OPERF is performing above the average with less risk than the average portfolio. Further, the Trust Universe Comparison Service, an independent compiler of universe data, consistently ranks OPERF in the top 10%, if not top 1% of all funds, large public funds in the U.S. Finally, we've managed to deliver this performance while maintaining a very low-cost structure. The Cost Effectiveness Measurement Survey has ranked OPERF in its high value-added low-cost quadrant for the 4 years since we've participated in that survey. Our performance measures in front of you shows OPERF's rolling five-year returns over various periods since 2002, and you can see that we've beaten the benchmark in all of those periods shown. The most recent five-year period...
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen.
Mike, please.
Thank you, Chair Jensen.
Thank you.
It's early. It's Monday. There seems to be a great deal of volatility there.
in that graph, if that's a five-year rolling average, there must have been pretty much an incredible difference between the 04 and 05 and 06 to make that kind of a change. Could you kind of discuss that?
Certainly. Senator Witzig, Chair Jensen, the portfolio, as you can tell by the asset mix, is largely based on what's affected by what's going on in the public stock and bond markets. So our performance, typically the way the OIC judges the portfolio and the way we judge the portfolio, is actually relative to a benchmark return. The markets themselves are volatile, and we have no control over whether markets go up or down. What we do have control is how our portfolio performs within that market environment. So we look at relative return numbers, which is what the graph is intended to show. But you're right, the absolute returns, you know, the raw returns bounce up and down.
Follow up. There appears to be a 100% difference in the value between 205 and 206 on your rolling average here on that graph.
Yes, Senator Witzig, Chair Jensen. Just to give you an illustration, in the early 2000s, let's go back even further. In the late 1990s, stock market was routinely up 20% a year pretty regularly. In the early 2000s, the stock market was actually down collectively in the two-year period, down 40%. So you get a sense of the kind of return differentials we're talking about in terms of the raw market that we're dealing in. So that, of course, has an impact on our portfolio.
Thank you.
Proceed, please.
Looking at the most recent five-year period, the numbers show that OPERF outperformed its performance measure as given to us by the Oregon Investment Council by 1%. 1% does not sound like a lot, but it's nearly double the expected level of outperformance in our long-term planning and what flows into the actuarial assumed rate of return that goes into the valuations that the actuary uses. 1% value added translates into real money. At $60 billion, 1% value added means $600 million a year, or $600 million just for that year. So over a five-year period, 1% annualized is well over $2 billion of added value to Oregon and Oregon's taxpayers and to the fund. If I could direct you to page 4, we have the Common School Fund. It has a targeted asset allocation of 50% U.S. equity, 20% international stocks, and 30% fixed income, a slightly different portfolio structure than OPERF. It has a different asset mix, which underlies the manager for a variety of reasons, rather. The Common School Fund portfolio is structured to meet distribution and real growth goals that differ from the goals of OPERF, and that's why the portfolio construction is different. Also, because of its size, we can't do some of the same things in that portfolio that we can do in a larger portfolio. So we don't have real estate and private equity, for example, in the Common School Fund.
Representative Cumble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you go over those that mix again?
Certainly. We actually have a graph I think we can make available to you that has a pie chart for the various portfolios we run. But while those are being handed out, it's 50% U.S. equity, 20% international stocks, and 30% fixed income.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Is that one of the reasons why we see, I guess, what I would consider to be a relatively poor performance on the Common School Fund?
Representative Crummell, Chair Jensen, if I may recharacterize that just a bit. I think performance has been good. Remember, the effect we have on the portfolio is relative, and our relative performance has outperformed the benchmark. But on an absolute basis, compared to OPERF, you're correct, it has performed at a lower level. That's because it does not have private equity and real estate, which just in the past year or two, private equity and real estate both have generated north of 40% returns for OPERF. And those asset classes are not in the Common School Fund portfolio.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could add to that, Representative Crummell. I mean, as a member of the land board, part of our goal is to make sure we distribute money out, which is what Ron was saying. The portfolio for the pension fund is really not germane here because that's a whole other target. We're trying to shoot for 8% returns. That's what the actuaries say. We've committed to retirees. In this case, we're trying to put out money every year on the growth of the fund. So we're trying to grow the fund so that part of that is retained earnings and also to make sure we distribute that. When we had the stock market crash a few years ago, we were trying to find ways to make sure we could have some distribution. If we had the volatility that the pension fund, we would have been very... it would have been very difficult for us to have had distribution. So it's really more acts more like an endowment. You're trying to grow the endowment. You're trying to get benefits off the endowment, and hence the asset mix. It is, again, stocks and bonds, and I would characterize the returns actually have been pretty good, in fact, very good for what we've been achieving. And that's in part the difference between the common school fund and the pension fund.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
With regards to the land holdings that the Common School Fund has, would you say that we've been able to absolutely maximize the benefit from those land holdings, or in some cases would it be better to dispense with the land holdings and then take the cash value out of those holdings and put them into the fund itself to grow the fund a little better?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krimmel, this discussion about what the state should do with its state lands is one that always arises every session. In this case, I think you're primarily it revolves around the Elliott State Forest. We have looked at that many a time, the land board has, and have come to the conclusion that that actually is a good asset for us to hold in our mix, and because it does throw off money to the Common School Fund. In fact, it's one of our biggest contributors outside of the pension, outside of these investments, that provides us money. We are in the process right now of re-examining. We have some constraints on the harvest levels. We are trying to change that so we can raise that so there will be additional money. From my perspective, it's an asset we should keep, and not only for today but for the long term. And we've done in my mind, a pretty good job in managing that for us to make sure we have some returns.
Thank you.
Yes, and just to be clear, the portfolio and the performance measures in front of you are the financial assets only and don't have anything to do with the lands and what the State Land Board does. This is OIC-driven portfolio that's financial assets.
Thank you.
I mentioned that we don't have real estate and private equity in this portfolio for reasons of liquidity. The Common School Fund historically, until recently, had not used active equity management either, and that is something that has recently changed. So we're now being a little more aggressive in the portfolio and trying to generate additional value added through the investment structure. The Common School Fund does leverage, as I mentioned earlier, the
Senator Johnson.
Stop just for a second. When you say investment structure, could you clarify a little bit what that means? I'm just not sure how you're using those words in this in the context you did.
Certainly, Chair Johnson, Senator Johnson. The two key drivers of investment performance are the asset allocation, the asset mix of the portfolio, which I had mentioned earlier. I'm not sure if you were seated at the time. It's 50% U.S. equity, 20% international stocks, 30% fixed income. Within each of the asset classes, then, there's a strategy employed and what we call manager structure, whether you're active or passive, what kind of managers, what style of investment you use, large-cap stocks, small-cap stocks, and that kind of thing. So by manager or by structure, I really mean the strategy within each of the asset classes. So the equity asset class had been purely indexed before, and it would go up and down exactly with the market. Now we do employ active management in that portfolio to a limited degree.
Follow up. And by active management, your own people, outside counsel, advice you get from the investment council, how's that work?
Certainly.
Just rely solely on Mr. Solomon.
No, ma'am. We use external managers.
Why not?
While I'm sure Mr. Solomon would generate good performance, we do use outside managers, and we use managers that are part of the OPERF portfolio, so that we get the economies of scale and low cost delivered to the Common School Fund.
Thank you.
At any rate, for all of the above reasons, while we're pleased that the Common School Fund has outperformed its benchmark in the recent period, the degree of outperformance is a little less than what it is in the pension portfolio. It's about 50 basis points a year over the past 5 years, and that applied to a much smaller portfolio, of course, means that the value added is less, but nonetheless $5 million of value added in the past year alone, just are based on the outperformance of this portfolio. Page 5 is the last investment performance measure that I'll discuss. That's the Oregon Short-Term Fund. That's a $9.5 billion portfolio at year-end, actually crossed over $10 billion at one point during the course of the year. Like OPERF and the Common School Fund, the OIC is responsible for the Short-Term Investment Fund, but unlike those other portfolios, the Short-Term Fund has an additional board recognizing the close ties between the portfolio and the agencies and municipalities that we manage money for. The Short-Term Fund is a very risk-averse portfolio of money market and short-duration bonds. The portfolio operates with a weighted average maturity of generally between 90 and 180 days. The average quality of the portfolio is AA+, as rated by Standard & Poor's, an independent credit rating agency, so it's a very high-quality portfolio. The Short-Term Fund beat its benchmark, which is 90-day T-bills, by 0.2% for 2006. Now, that margin doesn't sound like much, but in a money market-type portfolio where the variation in performance is very tight compared to in the equity markets, that's actually pretty good performance. And on approximately $10 billion of assets, that's an extra $2 million a year for Oregon. The Short-Term Fund ranks near the top of the Lipper money market universe on a net of fee basis.
Senator Johnson.
Nothing like coming late and having 20 bazillion questions. I apologize.
That's fine.
You're talking about huge amounts of money and very high performance. And I'm making the leap that managing portfolios of this size takes tremendous sophistication. How do you go about hiring the people to do this or selecting your outside counsel or finding qualified folks to do this kind of highly sophisticated management?
Senator Johnson, Chair Jensen, good question. We use predominantly external managers. And the Short-Term Fund, of course, is run internally, but for OPERF and the Common School Fund, we use external managers. The staff we hire is experienced staff. For the senior investment officers and even investment officer levels, we generally run national searches when we have an open position. So we'll post the Wall Street Journal or whatever sources to get a national audience and get candidates from across the country. Myself, I came here from Illinois. Our investment officer in private equity came from Boston. He was involved in running a fund of funds for Morgan Stanley. We have a gentleman in the real estate area that comes from the government of Singapore investment fund. So we've been able to attract, I think largely due to Oregon's quality of life, we've been able to attract, good people. We also have a good mix of a homegrown talent as well. Our senior investment officer in the equity area is an Oregonian sixth generation. But we do run national searches for staff. The external managers, we work with consultants when we're hiring external managers, and it's a collaborative effort. The staff works with the consultant. We each come up with a short list of firms we think fit the mandate that we're looking to fill. And that's based on national databases and extensive interviewing process where we're constantly, every day, every week, we interview managers and kind of keep a short list of managers that we're interested in. And so when we have a slot to fill, we usually have a handful of names that we're kind of ready to interview and dig a little deeper into their portfolios.
Follow up.
If you've got that kind of list going, what's your turnover rate?
Never been asked the question that way. Using the OPERF portfolio as the template.
Let me nuance the question a little bit more, just so that you know where I'm headed. We've had in Legislative Council, there are 14 drafters down there, and a high percentage of them are new, and people have left for various reasons. Now some of the new ones are leaving. And the case that they're making, and these are professionals, these are lawyers, the case that they're making is long hours, low pay. And I'm trying to figure out, when you said quality of life brings people here, quality of life only goes so far. And if your people were out in a competitive marketplace, they must be paid jaw-dropping amounts of money on Wall Street. I think all of us have seen the news footage about Wall Street bonuses, and I'm just trying to figure out, in these highly sophisticated jobs that you have, what's your turnover rate? How do you find these people? How do you keep them? How do you pay them? Because I'm sure that as good as they are, there must be people from the markets, the private sector, snapping at their heels all the time. And I'm just trying to get a sense of how can we keep this level of excellent return and keep this quality of folks here in Oregon to manage money on behalf of all of us.
Maybe I could just briefly step in here. Senator Johnson, I wholeheartedly agree that's the challenge we face. And it's not just this division, it's every division in my organization. Part of this, and Ron's staff, and I was here at the e-board, we talked about making sure we could retain quality staff.
I'm not sure any of us were at
the presentation.
Yeah.
Bottom line is, this group is compensated, and it's compensated in a way that's aligned with our interests. That is, they actually have a bonusing aspect to their compensation. When you compare it, though, to the private sector, and we went out and did a survey and looked at the private sector versus and public sector, by the way, for these same positions, in both categories, in both cases, we were below the average. So that's why I came back and said we need to pay these people more. We need to bonus them more. That's important because the long term is you need to make sure this office, whoever's sitting in the treasurer's office, has the staff to maintain the oversight that's required of these portfolios. We do work with the private sector, and I think, as you know, a lot of them have a lot of things to sell. We need to make sure we have the right people on our side saying that doesn't fit. And I'll say one last point, and I made this point before. Oregon has a great reputation in the marketplace. So already because of that and the way we manage ourselves, we do have the ability to see the best in the investment world, and we know who they are. And we have them in our portfolio. So we don't see a lot of turnover unless they don't perform. I want to underscore that. If they don't perform to our standards, they get canned, and that happens. We do move managers out. But more importantly, though, it's really maintaining a quality staff that meets the needs for our clients, whether it's a pension fund, the common school fund, the safe fund, so that in the end they get the performance that they deserve.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
I want to come back and visit this bonusing a little bit. I ran a state agency for 5 years, and I'm certainly not making any analogy between worrying about the Alkali Lake Airport and a multi-billion dollar portfolio. They're apples and oranges. But I know that occasionally I had people that I thought were just stellar, that the whole place would fall apart without them, and I couldn't pay them more because of the strictures of how state government compensates people. How are you able to have a bonusing program?
Want me to answer that, or do you want to answer that?
One of the three of you, I don't care.
Again, for the record, Linda Hagelin, Deputy State Treasurer. Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it's thanks to you. Back in
'96,
we recognized this same problem and came to the legislature, did a similar study, and came to the legislature and asked at that time for the permission to have a bonus structure based on excess investment performance of our investment officers.
Is that a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
I'll follow if you don't.
Is that are the criteria articulated someplace, or is it management discretionary? Or
no, it's tied directly to the excess performance, as Mr. Schmitz mentioned, the excess performance of the asset class over the benchmark, or actually its peers, that the investment council.
Sure.
Can I ask if that's in statute?
No, it is not.
So it's in rule.
It's in correct. It's in our policy. So it is written. I'd be happy to provide that to you if you'd like.
I'd love it because my concern is what you do is so critical, and I'm just trying to figure out how we can keep the resources that you have in your stable and not, as they're out interacting with the private sector, having them picked off one at a time by people who can offer a more attractive structure than perhaps the limitations of state government.
Thank you, Senator. I think that's a I think your question and your pursuing this here is valuable for us, and it strikes me, Senator, that it's not just perhaps in relationship to this industry and the money they're managing for us, but it may have application in some other areas, which I think you alluded to a little bit with the Legislative Council, where we sometimes seem like we're strapped and our positions sometimes don't seem to be competitive.
Thank you for rounding that out, because that's exactly where I'm headed. In this same hallway, we've had conversations in another committee, within this committee, we've had conversations with DAS about how do we make sure that we have created an employment environment that is attractive to both recruit and retain the best and the brightest across state government. And the absence of a salary survey that is the kind of salary survey that I think some of us would like to see is problematic. And I think it just goes back to the whole question of compensation at the state level, period, and what is the totality of that compensation, how do you gauge the kind of work done for what kind of compensation. So I think it's a question the legislature ought to take up at some point.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Please proceed. Please proceed.
Thank you. Chair Jensen is a member of the committee. Let's turn to page 6 or slide 6 in your presentation. And this is the percent of customers rating our service excellent or good. This is the performance measure that actually is our composite for the agency. This is not just for the investment division. And it's consistent with the statewide performance measure that you've asked all agencies to measure themselves against. Our target here, we have a scale of 1 to 4. We're wanting to see 100%. We're pretty darn close across the board. Those measures, all our lowest one is 95%. So we'll continue to work on improving that service with our customers and look to be a perfect match of 100%. I did want to make one follow-up comment on the discussion specific to Ron's team and how he's able to attract and retain folks. Another component of that is the nature of the money that we manage. With $75 billion under management, we get attention from Wall Street of their brightest people also. And that's very attractive when you're an investment professional to have access to that kind of knowledge and information. So it's a combination of being able to pay them somewhere better than a typical public fund, also Oregon, but the nature of the portfolio, the investment council, how we're able to work with them, and it's just a great investment environment that they're able to immerse themselves in. So there's some intangibles there, too, and that was just another aspect I wanted to bring out. Actually, now if you would turn back, I apologize for this, but if you turn back to slide 2, the treasurer covered our budget drivers. Ron has covered the performance measures that we have for the investment division and the investment program. And the final column in this table that you'll see is the POPs and our table amendments, what we're looking for to continue the excellence in performance of this team. As you've heard, we have a large number of assets under management, a small staff. There's 15 members in the investment division. What we're looking to add is more expertise in the short-term fund and how we manage fixed income investments. Specifically, we're looking for another investment officer to focus on the credit portion of the Oregon Short-Term Fund and also the credit portion of the monies that we manage for agencies. Currently, and you see that in your pie charts for the Oregon Short-Term Fund, corporate securities represent about 19% of the short-term fund, and that's about $1.8 billion. The team that manages the Oregon Short-Term Fund has a headcount of 3, and the senior investment officer in the fixed income area is the one that's charged with overseeing the corporates, and candidly, he needs help. So this is to get that help. The second request we have in our POP 102 is another investment officer in private equity. This is a portion of the portfolio that oversees over 130 relationships. Currently, we have 2 staff members overseeing that area, two investment officers, overseeing that area. We're asking for an additional investment officer to help oversee the private equity side of the portfolio, monitoring our current managers, looking for new managers for the portfolio. One of the focuses of this position will be also looking at co-investment opportunities with our current general partners. And the advantage there to the fund and therefore to you is the co-investment structure can be done at a lower cost. So we're looking to continue good returns and also save some money on fees. Following on down that chart, we have two table amendments. One is to bring staffing of three new FTE to the opportunity portfolio. This is an initiative of the Oregon Investment Council for the retirement fund to look at different types of private investments. So things here could include timber, these are going to sound scary, commodities. We have very specific investments that are infrastructure-like that we see that we really don't have the expertise to analyze to bring into the portfolio. So this would be a team that would have the resources and the specific knowledge to be examining those investments and bringing them to the Oregon Investment Council for approval. We're looking at, for that particular amendment, for a senior investment officer and an investment officer and then a support person. The investment council has targeted 3% of OPERF for this particular segment of their asset allocation. That's $1.8 billion. So we do need to have adequate staff to oversee that. The timing that we're requesting for that POP is the senior investment officer, the table amendment, senior investment officer and the staff member to start on July 1 of 07. And then we're looking for the investment officer to come in July of 08. So we would hire the get the program up and running and staff, and then that team would hire then the third member. Finally, in our table amendments, we have two reclasses. One is in our investment accounting area, which serves the investment division and our the agencies for which we manage portfolios for. And additionally, an analyst position in our public equity section. And this is a process of realigning their job descriptions with the duties that they're performing, and that drives a higher level of pay, of compensation.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you for walking us through these. With respect to the data that you're going to bring the panel, and that has to do with your rule about bonusing and compensation, could you actually lay it out for the individual members? You said there were 15 people on your fixed income team. Could you use that? Are they all subject to bonuses?
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, only the investment officers are. Our support staff are not.
And how many investment officers are there?
We have five, ten. Existing.
Could you get us a list of those for the
yes.
next
meeting? Yeah, a list and their salaries and the bonusing.
Yes.
Cool. Mr. Chair, for clarification, you know, tomorrow we'll be here to talk about two other aspects of this agency. Do you want us to bring that tomorrow, or do you want us to bring it
if you can
at the work session?
Tomorrow, if you can.
Chief, thank you. And that concludes the investment area of the Office of the State Treasurer. So now if I could have you turn forward to page 7. Thank you, Ron. I'll turn it back to the Treasurer.
Great. I just want to make sure you didn't have any more questions for the investment division because we're going to move on. Nope.
We have. I have more questions, but we will wait for a while.
Okay. I'd like to introduce Laura Lockwood McCall, who is the head of the Debt Management Division. She runs a very small group overseeing a portfolio of billions of bonds that the state sells, so issues. This is a real critical part of my organization. They every day practically are overseeing not only the outstanding bonds, but looking at the bonds that you want us to sell on behalf of the state. She works very closely with school districts and other local governments and their debt sales as well. I really give this group the name the Little Engine That Could because they are very small. They perform at a high level, and every day do something positive for the state of Oregon. Here, too, the bond market, much like the investment staff and the market they work in, is very complicated. The municipal market now is well over $2 trillion. We have to enter that market all the time to sell our bonds, to explain our story, to make sure the buyers of our bonds are confident that they will be repaid. To that end, we have always been well received. Regrettably, we got a downgrade in our credit, something that for me is one of my top priorities to make sure we continue to argue why that should change. But really, the bottom line here for this group is to squeeze every dime that we can and every bond sale that we can make. And I think Laura has brought a great deal of expertise to this division to help us do that, look at ways of working with agencies, help them understand the markets that we work in. And again, this is a great example of how this organization helps the state and helps you meet what you want to do. Over here.
Sure. Thank you, State Treasurer. Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of Debt Management, for the record. Excuse me. Good morning. Just briefly, the broad overview at the highest level, my division is the Debt Management Oversight Group for the State of Oregon. That includes oversight of both state agencies as they go about issuing their bonds, as well as on a fairly high level local governments throughout the state. As a way of backdrop in terms of the increasing volume of activity in the state, 2001 there were 1,500 transactions that my office tracked. We have a debt clearinghouse system where we publish a biweekly debt calendar of upcoming transactions, but we also keep information for the life of the bonds for all existing and outstanding debt of the state. Contrast that with 2006. We now have 2,500 separate transactions that we're tracking. The majority of those are local government. 2001, there was $2 billion of state debt outstanding and approximately $7 billion in local government debt. 2006, 5 years later, we're looking at $9 billion in state debt and $17 billion in local government debt. So that degree of information, complexity has occurred in a period where we really haven't seen any staffing increases in my division. In fact, we took a slight cut during the...
Let me back up and make sure I have this have it correct. In 5 years ago, you were what as far as the local government and state government?
Sure. A total outstanding indebtedness for local government 5 years ago was roughly $7 billion.
And today it's 17.
Yes, sir. And in the case of state debt, we had just over $2 billion of overall debt, and we're now at over $9 billion.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I know, Ms. McCall, that you did a very comprehensive presentation for Ways and Means, and I think that it was useful. Set that aside. Now, fast forward a month and 2 weeks into the session, and it's almost as though that conversation with legislators hadn't occurred. I just came from a meeting where we started out at a floor of discussing perhaps $100 billion in debt to look at some transportation projects. And by the time the conversation had emerged, albeit there was a certain jocularity about it, somebody said, why don't we just make it $500 million? I'm trying to ask from you how it is that you go about educating legislators that are in this process about where the terminus of our capacity to absorb debt is. And despite your best efforts to sit with Ways and Means legislators, the message ain't getting through. I'm trying to figure out how can your office help instruct this building with respect to the reality of what the state can bear in debt?
Through Representative Jensen, Senator Johnson, one of the jobs that my small division does is produce a State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report, which we had our meeting last Friday, and that publication will be distributed to the legislature in its in the next week or so. We look at current debt levels, particularly in the general fund, but also we look at lottery bonds, and we then forecast based on current debt service patterns and current revenues what prudent levels of overall debt would be. The case of transportation, we haven't really gone to that level yet, but we have an internal mechanism. There's a coverage requirement, for example, in ODOT's bonds, and we have tried to increase our capacity with some restructuring of their debt and the way that they manage their debt. But nevertheless, there is an upper limit whether the legislature recognizes it or not, there's an upper limit about how much debt we can afford given a revenue stream. So I would say we'd be happy to help, and more specifically, if there's different ideas on the table, to look at forecasts going forward and to see what's realistic. The rating agencies have given us good marks in the case of ODOT because we do have a plan. If that changes and the amount of debt that we plan to issue increases, then that could affect the state's credit rating for those types of bonds.
Mr. Chair, I'm just seeing the Treasurer articulate his desire to have our bond ratings restored to the highest levels, and this building trying to figure out how we can borrow more and more and more, and there seems to be a fundamental disconnect.
Yes.
Same thing. I'm just wondering, and I don't want to pull the rug from under the report because we're all eager to get that. But are there comparator states for Oregon, or is it too complex when we talk about indebtedness? I mean, I just contextually, where are we,
Through Representative Jensen, Representative Galizo, one of the things I was unfortunately, I kind of had a blow past on your committee in particular because we were running short of time. We look across 50 states, there is one measure that the rating agencies use, and it's called net tax supported debt. And we have actually, in our performance measure, I think it's on page 8, we show the net supported debt per capita. It's not a great measure, but it's the best we really have. There are other types of debt that are not part of tax-supported. For example, self-supporting housing bonds for single-family mortgages and conduit bonds for industrial development. But when we look at sort of the things across 50 states that everybody does, we build schools, we build roads, we build prisons, and office buildings, parks. The rating agencies do have that criteria. In my presentation, and I think in the report, what you'll see is that our medians, in other words, where we stood as net tax-supported debt per capita, or you can also look at net tax-supported debt as a percentage of personal income, we were well below the 50-state medians. That changed in 2003, 2004, primarily because we sold, three things. We did appropriation deficit bonds to cope with the downturn in the economy. State did a lot of budget cutting, but they couldn't quite close the entire gap. So that was one piece of it, about $430 million. The state also made a financial decision to pre-fund some unfunded liabilities in the pension system with pension obligation bonds at a lower cost than we would have otherwise had to pay. And we've saved quite a bit of money by doing that. I have a statistic that suggests that in this current upcoming biennium alone, because we sold those pension obligation bonds and invested them at a good time in the stock market, our payroll is $130 million less in payroll costs for unfunded pension liabilities. So that was a really good thing. However, what it did do is it added $2 billion of debt to our portfolio, and so that had a big pop-up, as you'll see. And then the last thing is the state approved roughly a $2 billion OTIA-3 program, and we're about a third of the way through of the selling of those bonds. So when we talk in our debt capacity study about what our ratios are going to be, they're going to be above the median. Even without the pension obligation bonds, we're roughly at the median now, but it's probably going to grow slightly above it. We're a growing state, and generally you have to pre-invest, and then you get the benefit over time. I will also say that personal income doesn't really capture all the income, so when we look at that ratio, it doesn't capture capital gains, which we are a state that's blessed with, a lot of that. And as well, it doesn't capture retirement income. And the rating agencies will be the first to admit it's an imperfect measure. Other states haven't necessarily issued pension obligation bonds, but they have unfunded liabilities, whether it be for pension or retiree health care. So that's really the best measure we have today, but at least gives you an indicator, another way of saying that, yes, our overall debt burden in the state has gone up.
Senator Whitson.
Mr. Jensen, thank you. I have two or three questions, if you would. First, on the, as you know, the secure rural schools and community payments have dried up for the counties, and doesn't appear that it's likely to, notwithstanding a filibuster, that's most likely not going to come back. That's about a $260 million loss to the counties. How will that affect their ability to service their $17 billion debt?
Well, out of the $17 billion, I'd have to go back to my computer to tell you what portion is the counties. It's probably not the largest portion. School districts represent the single biggest component of the 17 billion dollars in debt. I believe the school district cut is 31 million of that 200 million. So I'm not sure yet that the school districts couldn't manage, even though that was a cut. We'd have to look on a case-by-case basis for those counties to see what their indebtedness levels are. A report I saw last week showed places like Lane County and Douglas and a few others that had a fairly large chunk. My guess is that if they indeed lose that and they do have debt outstanding, that their credit rating will be impacted severely. The thing about debt is it's a fixed cost. And so I'm sure as they're looking at layoffs and they're looking at what they're going to have to do to manage, if those monies don't show up, that's probably not going to hopefully be the first or second or third thing on the table to look at. Having said that, there were states, when I worked in California, there were counties that did go into receivership for different reasons, but that does happen, where you basically have to get basically some time out in terms of restructuring your overall obligations to investors.
The question, I wonder if you could provide us with the this on page 8, this net tax-supported debt per capita is useful, but it would be also useful, I think, to see what a breakdown of what the actual debt per capita is per person, not only net tax-supported, but all of those other bonds that the state isn't going to allow to be defaulted.
Are you talking about the other state programs that are self-supporting or all the local government?
Yes, bonds, your housing bonds, all those things that are self-supporting that are out there that if they were, you know, I would assume the state isn't going to allow those to default without ruining our credit rating.
That's, I would think not.
And then also if you could give us the actual authorized debt, you know, not only the current debt, but that we've already authorized that has not yet been sold, such as the ATIA bonds. If you could do that on a per capita basis, that would also be useful. And one other question on the next slide here, you have a guarantee of $1.7 billion in school district bonding for a net savings of $2.5 million. That's like $1.5 savings per $10,000 of risk. Could you discuss that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Representative Jensen and Senator Rizzitt, we have a program called the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Program. And basically, we offer school districts, if they're interested, a guarantee, an underlying guarantee on their school debt. And they get the state's credit rating rather than their own credit rating if that's an improvement. Coupled with that, we have a state aid intercept program. So if for any reason they were to stumble and be in a position where they couldn't pay their debt service, we would be able to go ahead and make the payment, and then out of future revenues that would otherwise go to the school districts, repay ourselves as a state. The savings estimate is a conservative estimate because it's hard to homogenize all the different school credits to our state credit rating. But we've made an assumption as to roughly how much money per transaction we receive, the school districts receive in terms of the savings, in terms of the interest cost savings. And then we forecast forward over the life of those bonds what that value would be. So this is a per-year savings estimate on the amount of debt that's currently outstanding. The outstanding debtness, I believe, is on the third slide. It's a little over $1.5 million a year. And that is on slide 10. We have just under $1.5 billion outstanding.
Mr. Chair, I was just observing that that would probably not be an investment that I would make to co-sign a note for $1.50 for a $10,000 exposure.
That would be questionable. Unless you were feeling very generous on that day.
Unless you're dealing with your own children, of course, you see.
In which case, the liability might be more.
Yes.
Well, for what it's worth, the rating agencies, because of the state aid intercept, we're really guaranteeing to give them to use their own money to make sure that the debt service payment is made. They don't see this as a hit on our debt capacity, and they don't, you know, they don't basically say that this exposure is really something that the state has, because we're really just making sure and guaranteeing, as a trustee, if you will, of their money, that the payments get made. So in all cases, the state would not be really out of pocket.
Well, and I might add, Senator, that this is a pretty good partnership, because primarily this really helps a lot of school districts have a lower bond rating than we do. And they do get voter approval for their local bonds, so they have the ability to tax for those bonds. So I don't see this as a high-risk effort on our behalf. And in fact, it does save school districts money, which I think is bottom line a good thing.
I do want to highlight a few things that we've done in the past few years that I think, in terms of continuous improvement, my little operation has tried to do. I did mention that we worked on ODOT. We created a subordinate lien structure, senior subordinate lien structure, at a slightly lower coverage rate, which allows us now to optimize our debt portfolio. We have a first portion of variable rate, a small portion in variable rate with the majority in fixed rate, so that our cash assets are able to be matched. So you have a floating rate for the debt side, and you have a floating rate on the cash side, and that those two balance out and actually reduce risk overall by having that blend just at the optimal level. We also received rating upgrades from ODOT on the tail end of that. Standard & Poor's actually upgraded the senior lien debt to AAA, and the subordinate lien debt is now AA+, which is very good, among the highest transportation agencies in the United States in terms of its credit rating. We also received rating upgrade on our lottery revenue bonds, I think I've mentioned in some of my presentations, from Standard & Poor's and Moody's. AAA by Standard & Poor's for lottery revenue bonds, which have a 4x coverage, and we went from an A1 to a AA3, which is a one notch from Moody's. While I can't really give you precise as to how much we saved as a result of getting them, I can tell you that we were able to lower our bond insurance costs in the case of lottery bonds, and we were able to eliminate the need for a bond-funded reserve, debt service reserve account, but instead we were able to purchase a surety policy at a very much lower cost, which preserves debt capacity for the state on a going-forward basis. In addition, besides publishing the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report, we also published an annual Municipal Debt Advisory Commission report, which should be distributed fairly shortly to legislators, where we also give you trends and things going on in the local government world and state. We've been working on express bond programs with three state agencies. The idea is to provide tax-exempt finance to smaller chunks. It's not terribly cost-effective because you have a lot of rating agency fees, bond professional costs, typically, and usually the economies of scales suggest if it's under $10 million, you want to find somebody else to partner with because it's not terribly cost-effective. We're working with standardized bank documents for OECD, for Oregon Facilities Authority, which works with nonprofits, and we're beginning to work on the same program with Oregon Housing and Community Services. This will allow us to provide standardized legal documents at a lower cost. We won't need rating agency fees because it'll be privately placed, and we think that we'll be able to provide at least 1% to 1.5% savings to all these different variety of our customers, which will have real benefit. I think particularly the nonprofit world will start seeing this, and in many of your communities. Over the next year, we hope to roll out some marketing to offer the smaller nonprofit who's already got a bank loan for a mortgage for their buildings or their other facilities opportunities to lower their borrowing costs, which should really benefit us as a community.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. When you say rollout marketing, tell me what that means.
We have a free intern from the University of Oregon. He'll be preparing a nice 8.5 by 11 three-sided little marketing brochure. We use the internet, but what we want to do is get our Oregon Facilities Authority Board, which meets in Portland, you know, law offices, out into the community. So we hope to have our regular standard monthly board meetings, one in Pendleton, one down in Ashland, one out on the coast, one in Eugene or Salem. The goal being to start really doing outreach. Historically, the Oregon Facilities Authority has been a conduit issuer for nonprofits, usually the Reed Colleges, Peace Health, fairly large borrowers that are nonprofit. It's very different to start going out in communities, inviting chambers of commerce and city managers and city council people to come and hear about the fact that other types of nonprofits throughout the community could take advantage of the state program. So it's a fairly, hopefully, a fairly low-tech based on connections and networking.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Does your department have that marketing budget, or is there an overall marketing budget for the Treasurer's Office?
No, there isn't. The Oregon Facilities Authority is a volunteer board selected by the State Treasurer. They do hire an executive director, and we have just hired a new executive director after 17 years of prior director. And we selected someone who had the ability to, works in a law firm that already works with local governments throughout the state, to help get the word out. So we have at least through this authority, on a contract basis, an ability to get a little bit more information out to the public than we have historically.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator, Representative Edwards.
Could you speak a little bit to all the ways in which bond ratings affect the cost to the state, the pros and the cons? You certainly made improving Oregon's bond rating a top-tier issue this session, and frankly, I'm not sure that I am able to quantify in my own mind yet what the difference between having a AAA and AA minus versus, double B or triple B or, so could you speak to a little bit to that, then what type of dollars we're talking in, say, in $100 million of bond indebtedness?
Representative Jensen, Representative Edwards. There's lots of different bond programs, and so each of them get their own separate set of bond ratings. But when we talk about improving the state's credit rating, what we're really talking about is the state's general obligation, its underlying general fund rating. And when we run models and we look at historical trends, the difference between an A1 or an A+, depending on the rating agency, and the next notch up, which might be in the AA category, on average, over the long haul, because it varies, it's about 0.11% for each of those notches. So, I just took the first notch, and I said, okay, let's look at how much general obligation and general fund debt has the state issued over a fairly long horizon. On average, it has historically been about $485 million. Now, that's not to say that that number wouldn't go up over time, and you've got to kind of plan ahead, but if you look at the long haul, you take that interest rate spread for just that one little notch, and that works out to be a little over $4 million plus in interest savings per year. Then you've got to think about, well, all those school districts and all those other jurisdictions that get money from the state, if our boat floats up, then all of those other boats float up with them. It's a lot harder for me to quantify because I don't want to overstate it. I don't want to promise something I can't deliver. But I use some conservative assumptions of a couple basis points. They'll get a couple basis point savings, too. Well, each basis point's worth a couple $1 million. So if you think that if our boat floats up and they float, you can see that it can start adding up. I don't think it's hundreds of millions of dollars, but I think it's tens of millions of dollars per year. And the issue really is as the state continues to develop and more people live here, and we need to sell more bonds to cover the cost of new roads, sewers, and all the other things, like housing, all the things that go into developing a community, those numbers really can grow. But based on the history in terms of how much people have been issuing, that's roughly the range. For a specific program like Oregon, Oregon Department of Transportation, that number can be, it's more within the context of their borrowing. But what's happened with improving credit rating is it will lower our borrowing costs no matter what. And the lower we can borrow at, then we can leverage those same revenues that are coming in. So we can actually leverage further. So when we were getting those better credit ratings, we probably added $100 million of capacity, not that we're necessarily going to use, but just simply because a lower borrowing cost means we could, we could borrow more with the same revenue stream. So it's tough to say overall for everybody what it means. It's common sense, really. As you get better credit ratings, and your citizens are better off. I think it's a shorthand way of just saying that you're fiscally stable, which is the bottom line. What's really the most important, more than whether Wall Street says you are, it's what you do for your citizens and you do for your communities.
Okay. Thank you.
The only other two things I wanted to mention is we're always in the market looking for refunding opportunities. Sometimes interest rates work in our favor. Rates have been fairly low, but you have to have just the right combination of short-term rates so you can retire existing debt and escrows and long-term rates. This past year, we achieved $9 million in present value savings on state refundings of our bonds. We also oversee all local government refundings to make sure that bankers haven't slipped them a fast one and they're using the most efficient methods of restructuring their debt. And in the past two fiscal years, we've reviewed, I can't even tell you how many dozens, but overall savings for local governments of $143 million. So that's something else that we're doing on top of just selling the new bonds that are authorized by the legislature. In closing, we've also been training state agencies in the last 2 years to use some of the newer products that are available to us as debt managers. You've heard me mention the variable rate. It's just one more tool that we can use besides selling fixed rate debt. It's not for every situation, and it's not always appropriate. But in some situations, for example, Oregon Housing, Oregon's Veterans, Corner Mortgage Business, a blend of fixed and variable rate debt has been very appropriate and has actually reduced their risk because they said it's matching assets and liabilities. We've been training 68 state employees, including Department of Justice, as well as Secretary of State staff, on how to do interest rate swaps. We've entered into 6 interest rate swaps for one agency thus far, which is Oregon Housing Community Services Department. Just doing those 6 alone, we went from a variable rate mode to a fixed rate mode. It's called synthetic fixed rate debt. We saved $9.3 million compared to just selling plain vanilla fixed rate debt. So you can see these are really powerful tools if used well. It requires training. Again, as it was mentioned, it requires a more sophisticated staff than perhaps the state has had historically, but I think that the dollar value that we can achieve with the education, the training, and the tracking of the people who can manage the debt portfolio is more than worth the costs involved.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Is it your proactivity that reaches out to state agencies, or how responsive are you finding state agencies as you bring these products that have demonstrated savings?
Through the chair, Senator Johnson, I'd say it's a mixture. I do think that certain state agencies, out of financial necessity, perhaps, particularly the mortgage type of agencies, are very open to looking at new ideas. Other state agencies, which perhaps are more linked to the general fund, are a little more cautious, and I'm probably being more proactive in asking them to look at things. I get feedback that they're strapped for staff or they don't have the staff at the right training level to take on these additional burdens and responsibilities. So it depends on which agency. I will say that we're light years ahead of where we were when I arrived 2 years ago, and that we've done a lot of this training, and I'm hoping that in the coming next 2 years that we'll find more opportunities and uses for these products, and that the state agencies I've been working with will be more open to looking for ways to save money.
Well, Chair, just a comment. I think, colleagues, this is something we might want to think about. We're being encouraged constantly as we're reviewing budgets to look for best business practices out of agencies. And certainly some demonstration that agencies, particularly those that are managing debt, are coming to the authorities on debt management and looking for every opportunity to receive additional training, to reduce their load, to utilize new products. I think this ought to be one that we just flag for a best business practices to see if we can drive the herd to you rather than having you come out and hunt for them.
In fairness to them, the municipal debt industry has gotten more complicated, and those agencies are managing accounting of arbitrage rebates, secondary market disclosure, and in their defense, they, and as well as my staff, we're little engines, and we're pretty much up to our eyeballs, and so sometimes it's just sheer an additional body, not just the trained body, but an additional body to help manage just the complexity of and volume of activity. I will say what we are doing is trying to streamline all of our data input. We're trying to use the Internet and get our end users to input the information. That's one of my initiatives in the next 2 years in my operation, so I can transform some of my data input number crunching types into doing higher level thinking tasks. And I don't know if we'll be able to help other state agencies, but I know that I'm trying to set up a system that will allow us to get a little bit away from number crunching and re-inputting and more into these opportunities you described.
Thank you.
Jane Byer.
Thank you. I'm, again, new at this. Not sure if this is a question I should ask or can be answered, but do we recover any costs from local governments when we work with them?
Representative Byer. Unfortunately, the amount that we do recover is a small fraction of the cost of running the debt clearinghouse at the moment. We have an initiative we've been working on the state law commission to rewrite and sort of update all of state and local public finance laws, and I've been beating a drum not to impose a fee, but just to make sure that we have a framework in law so that we allocate reasonable fees between state and local government. And we'll do the work to make sure that we know how much is state and how much is local. But currently, we don't really cover as much as of the local government side as we probably ought to.
They do pay something.
They do pay something for towards, but I don't think the fees have changed in 15 years. So our costs have gone up a bit since then.
Thank you.
I think it was a great, perfectly great question. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of following up a little bit on Representative Byer's question, I guess there's really two questions that are coming to mind. One, with regards to fees to local governments, is that something that in law ought to be indexed so that as costs go up, you would have the wherewithal to raise your fees? But the other thing is, with regards to some of the training that Senator Johnson was referring to earlier, and that you were talking about, are the local governments utilizing that training also so to help them better manage their debt as well, and particularly the school districts?
Through the chair, Representative Crummell. Historically, prior to my arrival, the Debt Management Division would hold a once every 2 years local government conference to do debt training. Given my limited resources and the need to focus on some state issues, we haven't done that in the last 2 years. Myself and my staff have spoken at conferences put on by the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association. I do think there's an attempt through that organization, because it is sort of the joint city, county, state, to try and provide some debt education. It can't possibly be at a conference in the same level and depth as what we've been able to do with the state agencies. If I had the resources and the ability to cover those costs, I'd be very happy to do more on the local side. I will say we are going to try and do one thing. We do have a state bond manual. It hasn't been updated for a number of years, where we provide that to local governments just to understand the basics. We are trying to move that as well to a web-based solution that will be more interactive and more available. Once we get that up and running, again, with an intern, we hope, this summer from one of the universities, I'd like to try and use that web-based tool then to try and do maybe even a web-based training for local governments, where the cost of driving to a conference isn't as necessary as just being in an environment where people throughout the state could then ask questions of us, because we are sort of a resource for the state in terms of debt information.
I guess I would raise an issue with the training here, the training for other state agencies. I'm not saying that the training wouldn't be beneficial or isn't beneficial. I think it probably is very beneficial. But I might question whether it's the treasurer's office that should be responsible for providing the training per se. Some direction, some oversight, some input into it, but I'm not sure there aren't cheaper ways than using the head of a department in the treasurer's office to provide that training sort of thing. And I appreciate the quality that you probably will bring to the training, but I'm not sure that's exactly what we're wanting to pay for. And that's a discussion item on the, you know, with the committee, and it's a kind of a policy item, so we're a little astray maybe with it. Please go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, if I may kind of use that as a segue to move on.
Mr. Chair, before you do, Representative Crummell wants to correct me or something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was answered very well with regards to the training, but the question about indexing local government fees was not. Is that something that...
I can address
that. Quickly.
Yes. Currently, Representative through the chair, Representative Crummell. The current way we've envisioned this in this public finance rewrite is to delegate to the treasurer's office to establish these fees by administrative rule. So certainly, rather than put it into the statutes in general, there's a lot of the way the State Law Commission has decided to recommend to the legislature to keep track as things change, because there could be new programs and products. If it's in statute, it's tough to change it. So at least currently, that our thinking would be to use a rulemaking process, and that would make it easier for us over time either to put an index into that particular document or to modify it over time as different financial products and duties emerge.
Could I respond to the chair's statement about sort of Laura and her ability and the cost potentially? A couple of sessions ago, the legislature gave me the authority to begin to look at other ways in which we can make sell bonds. And Laura just described that, which have had cost savings. So you've entrusted me, and this is really one where there's a partnership between my office and the state agencies, and I think the key here is that partnership. It's always worked that way. In the end, it's my office that will either pull the trigger or not on a bond sale, but it's really working with the programs within these agencies. We have great relationships with them. There's a great deal of respect for this office, and I would submit it would be a lot cheaper to have Laura go in and work with these people than to hire somebody outside to go in and work with these people. Private sector tends to cost a little more money. So I think it's a good value, and it's
wasn't necessarily thinking of the private sector.
Okay.
Mr. Treasurer.
May I continue?
Yes.
Thank you. So to continue on with debt management, I'm not going to even have you turn there. Page 11 is the customer service response for, again, the agency. We've already covered that. So if I could have you flip back then to page 7 in your book. We've covered the budget drivers, the performance measures for debt management, and I don't think I need to say anything more to help you understand why we're looking for one additional staff member to this team. It clearly has had a tremendous growth in volume and complexity of transactions. If we're going to maximize the savings on every single bond sale, we need to have the staff available to do it, because where you make the savings is when you do the deal. And once it's sold, it's done. So we need to have enough staff up front to actually make sure that we're structuring the transactions in an optimal fashion for the state. And that would bring closure then to debt management.
We're on to finance?
Yes.
We're on to finance.
Thank you very much. Our last division we'd like to present to you today is the finance division. This is the division which covers many parts of the state government, and in fact, behind the scenes, one that you would probably never see, but we are the bank of the state. This group provides the liquidity for the state of Oregon. It is headed by Darren Bond and his team. They move billions, tens of billions of dollars through their organization to make sure that the government function continues to function. We're also a local bank for governments, local governments, where they park their money. They keep billions with us as well. And really, here too, a driving principle behind this division is cost savings, keeping our fees as low as possible, as competitive as possible, to make sure our customers are happy with the job we're doing. So with that, I'd like to introduce Darren Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasurer. I'll start out by just pointing out a couple initiatives. As Randall indicated, we are the central bank. We provide banking services. The finance division also does the investment accounting, provides investment reports to state agencies, and we do most of the backroom operations at Treasury. Relative to the banking activity, which is our biggest area of exposure, the largest number of customers we have, I'd point out a couple initiatives that we had. We're very technology-driven. And right now, a big push for us has been bringing browser-based technologies to agencies and local governments. We've instituted a secure web portal where agencies can pull down the thousands of pages of reports they get from us, saving hundreds of thousands of pages of reports that no longer need to be printed. We provide electronic funds transfers, ACH transactions over the internet to state agencies. We're in the process of rolling those out to local governments. Beginning in the spring, they'll be able to initiate their transactions over, currently they can do it over a voice response system. They'll be able to do it over the internet. We'll be the first agency test site for the digital certificates, which we'll use with local governments to ensure that we have a secure transaction. And we anticipate we'll have thousands of digital certificates out in the hands of local governments that they'll be able to use either directly with us or with other financial activity and transactions they have going on. We also provide cash management consulting and training to state agencies to help them take advantage of the tools that are available to most effectively manage the state's finances. I'll quickly walk you through the performance measures as we try to catch up in time. On page 13 of the expense to asset ratio for the Oregon Short Term Fund simply shows you how much money we save by managing those funds and providing this banking business internally versus externally. In 2006, we saved about $38 million by managing this internally versus having it outsourced. Page 14 and 15 are simply trend measures. They give us an idea of our local governments are our voluntary customers. State agencies are a captured, captive audience. So we measure our local government activity as a measure of service, and we look at the dollars they have with us and the number of participants that we have, and we look at those participation rates to give us an idea of things that we might want to pay attention to. For instance, if you look at the dollars in the short-term fund and that mix, look into, that's on page 15. In 2005, we would have expected normally to see a reduction in that dollar volume because of the interest rate moves. Generally, as the interest rates move up, the Oregon short-term fund, by virtue of its size, tends to lag the market, and we tend to see local governments run. And, in fact, they didn't. And we attribute a great deal of that to the ease with which they can manage, to the online reporting that we're providing them and the other service that we perform. So if we turn to page 16, gives you an idea of the enterprise value that you get from the treasurer's office negotiating bank transaction fees.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you. Before you go on, Darren, back at on page 15, I noticed that in 2006 there was a little bit of a blip there where it tended to drop. Is there a particular reason why it dropped? Is it because the state agency amount dropped, or is it because the local government dropped, or is it?
We just saw the total dollars dropped in the fund. We still are running a pretty steady mix between local government dollars and state agency dollars. But if you notice, both state agency and local government dollars dropped. So.
And is there a particular reason why the number of dollars in the short-term fund dropped? Is it because local governments were pulling more out, state government was pulling more out?
No, I don't really know right offhand.
Okay. And that's not dropped. I can say this is not attributed to a reduction in returns. In fact, returns have gone up for that portfolio.
Right. These are
that's what I'm driving.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. These are just the balance. This reflects the balances that the agencies and the local governments carry with us. So their balances were smaller. Therefore, our total balance of the fund is smaller. Sorry about that.
It's a checking account.
Right. For state agencies, in fact, this is their checking account, or their checking accounts are there. On page 16, performance measure number 7, this shows you the cost savings you get from me managing the banking relationships directly and negotiating the fees. If you would have taken all of our various transaction activity and consolidated it, which you asked us to do, and look at how much it costs us per transaction, if we didn't directly negotiate the fees lower on behalf of the state, we'd have paid about 15 cents a transaction, and last year we paid four. So that's a reduction in price from 2004, the last snapshot we took, and that the reduction in the target comes from the fact that we've moved to more of a mix of electronic transactions, or more electronic transactions in the mix, which pushes down the overall cost. The reduction in our charge is, as a percentage-wise, considerably larger. That's because we renegotiated our two key fee drivers with our key provider and had substantial cost savings realized through those negotiations. And that gets back to Linda's.
Yes.
But I would point out, before Linda goes to that one, that a key measure you don't see here on a customer service basis, which I'm extremely proud of,
it's
my
on
staff.
Page 17.
Yeah, but it's not on page 17. It's the, but it should be here, and that is that when we ask the question in our customer survey of our customers in the finance division, if you had the choice of banking somewhere else, or if you had the choice of getting your investment accounting activity somewhere else, would you go and do it? 100% of my customers say no. They would choose to continue to bank with the state treasurer. I think that's just about as good of a statement as to the level of customer service the treasurer's office provides as anything.
So when you hit 105% saying that, we'll know. That
then you can really question my math.
So if we can...
Sorry.
Well said.
Turn back to page 12. And again, this is just our summary page. You've heard about the budget drivers for our banking services area. Darren has quickly gone over the performance measures, and it was very quick. But a theme is our increased use of web-enabled services to bring efficiencies to state agencies as well as driving down our costs. You also heard some initiatives in the debt management division that are going to be using and leveraging web-enabled services also. Because of the nature of those services, the need for them to be reliable at all times, and that we must have very secure access to that information, the burden that is placed and the responsibility on our information services division, we currently have a half of an FTE.
In the mic, please.
I'm sorry. A half of an FTE overseeing the connectivity and the actual security of these systems. We're asking for that position to be raised to a full FTE. So our request here, a table amendment to you, is a half of an FTE in information services. So that concludes our Treasury Services side, and I think what you've seen from a theme standpoint is volume increase, more demand, more complexity in our agency has driven us to ask for more resources in terms of staff from you. What that does mean to our office, however, is that the footprint that we have right now is not sufficient to handle our staff, and we're actually going to be talking a little bit more tomorrow about the need for the offices of the treasurer to be moving to larger quarters. And we just need more room to house our folks. We're seeing growth now. There's actually initiatives that we see on the table at the Investment Council that are going to continue to cause us to look at getting more resources to execute those transactions. As we discussed here, there may actually be some more activity on the debt management side from an education, more outreach that we could do. So, again, as a centralized basis, investment in the resources, the staff that we have here, are leveraged across the state as all agencies look to us for assistance in issuing debt, running all their banking transactions through us, investing all of the state's money.
Okay, questions? One question?
Mr. Chair? Thank you. I have a couple of things. One is with regards to the customer service rating, Darren was mentioning 100% of his customers said they would stay, and I assume that that means the local governments that bank with you also.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes, they were local governments, and and state agencies both were surveyed. Okay.
Second thing is you mentioned that the state treasurer was going to be the first agency to use digital certificates, and that you're really a test agency. Why is the state so slow on this? Any idea? The reason why I ask is the private sector's been using digital certificates for years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, in the interest of interagency harmony, I will just say that it's taken a long time for the contract to get negotiated with. It's a DAS-driven contract. It's taken a long time. We've been waiting with bated breath to have an opportunity to put it into place. So now we do.
Okay. Thank you. And then one last thing, Mr. Chair, and that is on page 16. Your target and your actual is a little bit misleading, and the reason why I say that is because it looks like your target would be to actually have the cost be higher per transaction basis. And so,
well, that's true.
When in actuality your costs are lower, which I'm very happy to see that. So I don't know how you fix it. Misleading.
And I'll jump in on that. And that is one of the challenges with the format of the performance measures that you have imposed on us, is you have to think a little bit about what's actual and what's target. So sometimes it's counterintuitive.
I would just point out, Mr. Chair, that in that respect, of course, what we really, instead of just sort of numbers on a page in our performance measures, what we really should be looking at, and this is not directed at the state treasurer or any particular agency, but what we really should be looking at is what the outcome is and how that ties to the budget, so that when we are investing money, we can see what the actual return on our investment is.
Thank you, Representative. And we're going to close the public hearing.